Hello, listeners. Welcome to Business IQ Radio here on 105.1 WBNH. I'm Don Byrne, and I'm here as usual with my friend and colleague, Andrea O'Brien. Hello, Andrea.
Hello, Don. So great to be here with you again.
Boy, we've got a great show for today, but before we get into that and give our listeners a little bit of a preview, I just want to recognize and thank you for the hard work you did last night. We both attended the SBA New Hampshire Small Business Person of the Year Award Ceremony, in which 9 awards were given out to a variety of people. And listeners, you may look forward to hearing a show. We actually had the opportunity to interview many of the people involved in that process at the event, and it was really a terrific event, don't you think?
It's always a great event. And there were, in the room, we had a lot of bankers, we had industry professionals, board members, SBA officials.
And most importantly, entrepreneurs.
And entrepreneurs, yes. And it was a time to get a little recognition for those individuals who were honored for all their hard work, commitment, persistence. You know, they amazing winners this year.
And the variety of businesses was pretty impressive. We had 2 brew crafters, and we had the opportunity to interview both of them, and they make very different kinds of beer, which I found fascinating. In fact, I was impressed by the fact that I asked the question, gee, do you keep your recipes secret? And they told me no, that they actually freely share their recipes with one another. So I think another field trip to one of those locations, would probably both, is in order in the future.
Yeah, so we had the veteran-owned business of the year, which was Abel as an Ebenezer Brewing Company in Merrimack.
Right, they gave us a great story about the origin of their name, Abel Ebenezer, who led the Pine Revolt here in New Hampshire, which was seen as a precursor to the American Revolution.
Yeah, and then the other one was a company called Throwback Brewery, like throw one back. And that was a woman-owned business. 2 women own that brewery. And again, and you know, it's so great to see women brewing beer.
And they took over, again, in the sense of history, they took over, as I recall, a historic site from 16XX, and they were able to rehab the entire space and take what was basically a junk heap. And apparently it's quite a lovely place and a good place for food. So I think, again, a field trip
excellent.
Is in order.
Right. That's in Northampton, yeah. Throwback Brewery. But some of the other winners, the person of the year was Jake Redder, a PhD of Solyndra Medical up in Lebanon, New Hampshire. We had Young Entrepreneur of the Year, which was Quinn Warden, PT United. He's a physical therapist. And we had Exporter of the Year, Jill Aaron, Hydrocomp, Inc., out of Durham.
Yeah, that was a very interesting story to hear her talk about the design of propellers and some of the nautical software they developed for the nautical industry, the ocean-going industry.
She exports all over the world.
Yeah.
And we had a Woman Small Business Owner of the Year, which was Granite Start, a daycare, a child care center.
That was very touching, very moving.
Yeah, Joyce Goodwin.
Presentation.
Yeah, well, it was from the heart. She loves those kids. And the family-owned business, Timothy Emery of Tim's Truck Capital and Auto Sales of Epsom. Financial Services Award winner was Steve Henchy from TD Bank. And last but not least, we had a Small Business Champion of the Year, who actually was also a guest on our program earlier this year, Marty Parishon and his partner Todd Workman for the revitalization effort of Franklin.
And let me brag a little bit that when Marty got up to make some remarks to thank everybody, he recognized a certain individual, Andrea O'Brien, who he credited with their success. And so congratulations to you, because you absolutely shared in their success, and people understood that. And thank you for the work you do at the Small Business Development Center.
You're welcome. You're too kind. So should we introduce the guest?
Yeah, let's talk about our guest.
So our guest today is Jerry King. She's holds a doctorate and she's a social psychologist and organizational consultant. She works in many different sectors throughout the United States and abroad. She is a facilitator and a keynote speaker, and she presents on numerous stages and conferences. She's a wonderful speaker and facilitator. Her company is called Human Dynamics Associates, Inc.
They're up in Concord, I believe.
Yes, in Concord. And her expertise includes a wide range of topics such as supervisory skills, team building, conflict resolution, effective communication, all things that are essential to a healthy, happy, effective workplace. And she's authored a book. It's called The Duh Book of Management and Supervision, Dispelling Common Leadership Myths.
Yeah, I had an opportunity to speak to her briefly, who's very good sense of humor. I think it's going to be a very interesting discussion. And this topic of conflict resolution touches on every part of business. That's not all that she does. I also have questions I want to ask her about the stress that people are undergoing because of work from home, isolation, and from travel, and just a whole variety of different things, including just family pressures, and family pressures felt both by parents as well as single parents who certainly have a real challenge ahead of them. So this, I'm sure everyone's going to really, really enjoy this. And I'll also point out that you will be hearing, listeners will be hearing some promotions for our show starting in the near future. And one of the promotions we'll be doing is to let you know when we are ready to put out the interviews from last night's Small Business Small Business Administration Awards Dinner. So that will be a lot of fun. And other than that, things are going well over at the SBDC. I understand that you folks are beginning to get your budget for the calendar year, and things are looking up a little bit.
Yes, I think the federal budget passed, or at least there was a continuing resolution that took some of the heat off, because you know federal budgets are under scrutiny, and thankfully I think we survived.
Well, I think they're making good decisions because of the work that you guys did, and anybody who attended last night would know about that. If people wanted to learn more about the award winners, I guess they can go to the SBA website.
Right. Yes, that
I think it's
SBA.gov.
.gov, right.
Right. And maybe put New Hampshire in there also, so you get to the SBA awards in New Hampshire.
And if they wanted to potentially be one of the winners in the future, they should go to the SBDC, the NHSBDC website, and learn about all the services you folks provide.
Right. Well, they can be a winner without us, but they have to be well-run and have achieved something to qualify for a nomination. So we can help them with that.
Well, on that note, I think what we can do is probably bring in our guest to talk to us about conflict resolution, more effective workplace, and everything related to really having a better work environment and being more successful.
Well, welcome, Jerry, to our show. And I wanted to just ask you, do you like to be called Dr. King?
I absolutely do not.
Okay.
I'd like to be called Jerry.
Well, welcome to our show, and thank you for spending the time with us today. And the topic of conflict resolution is, I think, a very important one because it's probably part of life. Conflict is part of life. We can't get through it without it, and yet it can really disturb the workplace if it's not handled appropriately.
I'm looking forward to figuring out how you can help co-hosts who may have conflict. Just because I have a friend who has a friend.
A friend, all right.
Yeah, who has a co-host of a radio program, and there's chronic and constant conflict. But before we launch into that topic and some other of your achievements, I'd like to just ask you to tell us a little bit about yourself and how you ended up in New Hampshire.
Oh, wow. Well, I grew up in Connecticut. My husband grew up in Hanover, New Hampshire. His dad taught at Dartmouth. We met at a camp where I was the dance counselor. It was a camp in Connecticut. This was when Ron was at Cornell and I was at UConn. We then eventually lived in Philadelphia. We lived in Oregon. We lived in Michigan. And we decided to come back to New Hampshire. We absolutely love cities, but we decided we'd rather live here and go to the city for fun than live in the city and come here for fun. So we've been here for a number of decades.
I hope, by the way, city doesn't mean Nashua.
Right. I actually, my intent was to be a professional dancer. and to be in New York City. But I still choreograph for a theater company.
Oh, that's so interesting.
So I have to pick up on this because you said you were a dance counselor at a camp.
Right.
And of course, for those who are listening live, this will make sense in the news. But for those of you on the podcast, you can look back because we're recording this in the beginning of May. They just sold the leather jacket that Patrick Swayze wore.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
When he's, you know, no one puts a baby in the corner in their big dance sequence there.
Wow, that's interesting.
So, right, I heard that on the news this morning, and here I have a dance counselor.
And here you have a dancer. Right.
Organizing the big dance at the end of the camp year.
I'm curious, is it ballroom or ballet?
I studied ballet and tap and jazz, but what I eventually went into, what I choreograph now, are for musicals.
Oh,
so
wonderful.
It's really based on jazz. What happened is I was going to be a dancer. I kept taking a left and going to college instead of a right to New York.
Right.
But I've been doing it all my life, and
nice.
It provides balance.
And is your husband much of a dancer?
He's a fabulous dancer. He's a really good dancer.
Oh, you lucked out.
I know. I did. He is an architect by training. And so sometimes when we'd work on shows together, he would design the set. We always thought this would be fun. We'll work on it together. Of course, we didn't see each other throughout the entire rehearsal schedule, not until opening night.
So at some point, you decided to focus on psychology, and and you've got your own company, which centers around that. And just can you tell us a little bit about what your company does?
Sure.
Did you go to school in Connecticut, by the way?
I did my undergrad in Connecticut and 2 master's degrees and a doctorate at UNH.
Oh, very good. Wow. Right here in the state.
So over a number of years, the Human Dynamics Associates was started as a psychotherapy partnership. And in fact, there are still psychotherapists there. And that's what I did. Originally, I was a psychotherapist, went back and decided to get a doctorate in social psychology and moved into organizational consulting. Thank goodness I have a background as a therapist. I can't tell you how often that helps me. So I work with profits and nonprofits. I work in the private and public sectors. Every day is different, although because they're human beings, every day is underlying the same. It wasn't one day, it might be 5 people, another day 1,000 people at a conference, another day a manufacturing plant.
Hmm.
And I find it fascinating. I'm going to semi-retire when I'm 102. That's my plan.
It's beautiful.
And I understand that you've done some writing.
I have. I write articles quite a lot. I published a book that has a very snippy title. I don't think I'm snippy, although the audience might think differently by the end of the show. It's called The Duh Book of Management and Supervision, Dispelling Common Leadership Myths. And it came from experiences over the years of talking to people in high places. By the way, any stories I tell you are from other parts of the country for confidentiality reasons. I don't want people thinking, oh, I know who that is. But over time, talking to people high in the hierarchy, it's very hard for me to talk about hierarchy because they believe in equality. And I will say to them something simple like, you know, if you treat people better, I bet they'll be more productive. And the response has often been, really?
Oh my gosh.
Like a 14-year-old, duh, kept going through my mind. And I finally decided, oh, what the heck, I'm at a point in my career, I'll say what I think. And if people don't like it, they can tell me. And they do.
That's great. And so you talk to business leaders, people in management, about how to build a stronger organization, mostly?
I do. It's not just that. I do 3 basic things. I do a lot of training, which includes supervisory training, conflict resolution, managing change, and team building. And then I facilitate. I facilitate mergers and acquisitions, strategic planning sessions, conflict, if there's departmental or interdepartmental conflict. And then I speak at conferences periodically.
So are you usually brought in by somebody from human resources?
Not always, interestingly. Sometimes it's from people at the top. Sometimes it's from people who work there who talk to folks at their organization and say, "I think we need this." The variety is enormous. And because of technology, it often comes from the website. Referrals are my favorite way to get people, but often comes from the website. I actually had a call where someone said, we want to hire you. And I said, don't you want some references? And they said, no, we really like your website. And I said, well, then you want to hire my graphic designer.
Right, right. You know, you mentioned technology, yeah. And I'm guessing that technology in the workplace today is a hot point for conflict. And I'll just tell you why I say that. When I'm writing an email to someone, mm-hmm. I read it three different ways, right. You know, to see if there's any way they could take it offensively. I mean, it wouldn't even be an offensive topic, but you never know. People read something depending on their frame of mind.
Exactly.
They may or may not, you know, like, well, what is she saying? Well, that thanks a lot. Was she, you know, saying thanks a lot? Or was it, well, you know, thanks a lot? And so how much has technology contributed to conflict in the workplace?
Well, know that I'm as addicted as everybody else to technology and email, but email and texting has caused huge communication problems because, to your point, people read it in the mood they're in, not in the mood it was sent. So if I say, did you do that report? I could ask it that way. I could say, did you do the report? I could ask it 17 different ways with 17 different meanings. If you're feeling guilty about not doing it, you're going to take it as a chastisement. So what I suggest is if there's tension in emails after two exchanges, stop. I promise you it will not get better because what you read the first time is really what sticks. And talk to the person, preferably in person, but at least on the phone. If there's a conflict and it's a problem, you can continue the argument. But if there isn't, at least you've clarified that.
Well, and to that point, it seems to me my experience is both texting and sending emails really encourages a passive-aggressive attitude towards things. You're willing to do or present yourself in ways that if you actually look the person in the eye and there were these other levels of communication, nonverbal communication taking place, might not develop, or you might not be, you may not be as open to being as aggressive in doing things.
I think that's probably true. There's another piece of that. And that 65 to 85% of communication is body language. It's not the words you say or write. It's your eyes, your tone of voice. Interestingly, you're the least knowledgeable person on earth about your own body language. So if you walk in looking grouchy, you don't know you look like that. And people will think it's something they did. So I encourage strongly that there be an environment where people can at least ask, is it about me? Is it about here? You don't have to tell your life story, but you can at least allay their fears.
Maybe we need to put a mirror at the entrance of every conference room.
That's a great idea. Never thought of that. Wouldn't that be fun?
Or maybe carry around a little face on a stick where you just have my smiley face. Good morning.
Right. That's right.
It's very difficult. You know, and not only that, but sometimes communication style. Like I had a supervisor once that asked everyone in the group, how would you like to communicate?
Oh.
You know, what's your preferred form of communication? Uh-huh. And I was so surprised by that because normally I think it's always been top down.
Sure.
Like, here's how I'm – so I was, like, taken back uh-huh. a little bit. I'm a talker.
Yeah.
And I don't – and I think I can say it more quickly than I can put it in an email and get more information, like real-time information. Mm-hmm. But there – are individuals who will not pick up the phone,
absolutely.
Who insist on I found it very frustrating sometimes, actually.
Right. And you were talking about conflict earlier. Conflict is not usually about the issue. It's about how it's delivered. So if you and I are upset with each other, within minutes, we'll be saying, you always talk to me like that. You never listen to me. We're not talking about the issue at all anymore, although we might emerge saying we just argued about this, this, and this, and that's not really true. So it's about stylistic difference. And if we understand each other's styles, that they're not excuses, they're explanations. So an excuse is, this is who I am, you just have to live with it. An explanation is, this is who I am, this is who you are. How do we work that out? How do we negotiate it?
Well, it's interesting, as I was mentioning to Andrea in the beginning of the show, I just got off the phone with a colleague who's out in California and very, very well-known, a PhD physicist who has a very distinguished career and has changed. She works actually helping police departments around the country uncover cold case and solve cold
wow.
case problems.
Fascinating.
And so she has been a pioneer in using genetics and DNA to help solve cases. Mm-hmm. And this has been a bit controversial with some of the positions that she's taken on some things. Mm-hmm. And some of her colleagues were contacting her, and through a blog, through a passive-aggressive environment, really getting into the whole area of cyberbullying.
Oh, absolutely.
This is something that we also hear a lot about in terms of high school and children, mm-hmm. in terms of conflict. And yeah. and I think it's not new that people were doing that. Everybody grew up being teased. But the mechanisms, the tools, the technology, as Andrea is saying, have really broadened to give mm-hmm. us more venues to do this. And I wonder if you have any opinions or thoughts about it. And I'm sure, I know for a fact, cyberbullying takes place in corporations among adults as well.
Sure it does. It's easier to do it that way. I don't like bullying at all, ever. But to your point, if you're teased on the corner, the people who hear it are two or three people around you. If it's cyberbullying, anybody can read it. And we've heard some horrific stories coming from adults, but particularly coming from youngsters who have taken their lives, who have fallen apart, who have had to change schools because of the sort of thing that's going on. So we really need to get back with kids to tell them the ramifications of that. I mean, they're not always thinking clearly. If you talk to the kids who did it, most of them would feel terrible and awful, but we need to do more preventative work around that. But also, it is happening among adults. And I had the news on this morning, and people were talking about someone who's very famous and the horrible tweets that went out about him. Because of something he did the other night, which was absolutely heartfelt. Somehow people think, oh, I wouldn't say this to someone's face, but somehow I can write it and I can send it out to the world.
Because there's no consequence? There's no immediate consequence, no immediate feedback?
Yes, and responsibility for it. And if you're doing it person to person, you see the person's response. You mentioned that. And maybe it'll stop you. Because you see the tears in his eyes, or you see how upset or distressed the person is.
Or a fist approaching your nose.
Yes, that's
at
right.
At least where I grew up.
That's right.
What is the responsibility of management, do you mm-hmm. feel, in a case where maybe this is going on between two coworkers? How much do you feel management should step in and, set it right?
Well, first of all, there has to be zero tolerance for certain behaviors. And that has to be just an absolute given. But people have to understand what that is. So just to say be nice to people doesn't help. You may say something in a very aggressive way and you think you're being perfectly nice. And you may not be at all. So I think everybody has to take responsibility for it. What I often do is if I'm doing conflict resolution with a group, I never, ever interview people individually because then I hold secrets. So I usually suggest supervisors don't do that either. Bring people together, and then you can have a conversation about it.
Interesting. You're listening to WBNH 105.1 Bedford Community Radio. This is the Business IQ Radio, and our guest today is social psychologist and organizational consultant Jerry King. She is the president of Human Dynamics Associates and is here today to talk to us about conflict resolution in the workplace. And because we know conflict in the workplace can degrade morale mm-hmm. and impede, organizational efficiency. And so we're here to hear about tips and, maybe even I was going to ask you about.
Why are you looking at me as you're looking for tips here?
Because I'm like, I think it speaks for itself, Don.
Thank you very much. Our listeners
know.
Oh, and she wrote that down and handed it to me.
But I'm wondering, I don't want you to tell anything that you can't say, but can you give us a case study on, and I don't want to put you on the spot either, but maybe, a situation where, that you thought was fairly typical and how it might get, resolved.
Yeah. First of all, there's this feeling that we should not have conflict. And I want to make a case for conflict because it's how it's handled that can be inappropriate or the stylistic difference. Without conflict, without diversity of thought, we'd never invent anything. We would never change anything. Without inner conflict, you'd never buy a new car, move, or change your career. So conflict is okay. And diversity of thought is okay. It's how respectful are we about each other and with each other. Now, I've been on this roll to try to do something that has not been easy. It takes 6 months or a year to get there, and that is to help people create blame-free and gossip-free organizations. So very easy to understand, very hard to do, but the result is it reduces conflict. Blame-free is it doesn't matter who's to blame. What matters is what's not working gets fixed. And the pushback I get is, well, then people won't be accountable. The response actually is they're more accountable because they know there's not a punitive response. So they're early on will say, I messed up. I made a mistake. I did something wrong. And the response is, let's sit down, figure out what happened so it doesn't happen again.
Well, you know, the proof point of that is the quality initiative that took place in the 70s, started in Japan, where everyone was empowered to stop the production line if they saw a problem. And yes, it was a no-blame environment. It was encouraged to say, everybody take responsibility for the quality of the outcome. And, right, you know, they have thrived in terms of the quality of their production. So as you said that, that's the first idea that jumped into my mind.
That's a really good point. And wouldn't you want to know early on,
sure,
that something was wrong? So the blame-free is a very interesting concept because high, you mentioned hierarchy. High in the hierarchy, we talk about accountability. And when people are low in the hierarchy, we talk about blame and fault. Now, so that's already discriminatory. The gossip-free is you talk to people instead of about them. It doesn't mean we don't support each other. So if you come to me because you want, you're distressed with her, I'm making this up, nobody told me a thing. What I say to you is, how can I help you talk to her? Because talking to me about her is not helpful. Now, the thing that really shocks people is that includes talking to a supervisor about a colleague. It happens all the time. People are always complaining about their colleagues to their supervisors. But when I ask supervisors if they have two or more children, what they do when one of the kids is upset with the other, they almost always say, I say, work it out with your brother or sister. Stop tattletaling. It's fascinating, isn't it, that they do it at home and they don't do it at work. So this is why it takes a long time. And my favorite example is a place that is now gossip-free. I was so excited. And I said, what's it like to work here? And this guy said, it is the most boring place on earth. There's right, no one to talk about around the coffee pot.
No drama.
No drama. No one to talk about. But what he said is, when I walk by the coffee pot, people are whispering or giggling. I know they're not talking about me, because they'd be talking to me. If my boss walks in and doesn't look happy, I know it's about not about me, because I would learn about it within 5 minutes. And it's boring notwithstanding, it's the safest environment he's ever been in.
That's great. That's, yeah.
Now, you must run into situations where people don't realize that there must be unintentional conflict. They don't realize that they're causing conflict.
Yes.
There are just some personalities where people come across, I guess the polite way to say it is, they're very direct.
Yes.
In terms of doing things,
yeah,
and perhaps not as well-tuned in the social graces as they should be.
Right.
And I'm guessing that exists in business as well.
Sure, it does. And what I say to people who are very assertive, sometimes aggressive or direct or sound opinionated, you have to tell people it's okay for them to push back and to respond. Often that person thinks, well, people will just tell me if they don't like what I'm saying, because they would. So it's up to them, really, to invite people to do that. And then for them to say, oh, it really is okay. Or you really can change your mind.
Hmm.
So yes, we do have personality styles. Again, I want to reiterate, they're not excuses. They are explanations. So we need to share styles. The other piece about this is the workplace is like family. So you hear the same things at work you hear at home. You're in my chair. You took my paper. They like them better than they like
Who
us.
Who ate my lunch?
Those of us who are only children are really baffled by that, by the way. I have permission to tell this story. My husband's one of three. We've been married about 1,000 years. And to this day, if we're cutting cake, he looks to see how big my piece is. Now, our son's long out of the house, realized he could have all the cake. And one day I said, what are you doing? He said, I don't know. I can't stop.
and you learn, as I'm sure you know, the way you do that is you say, you can cut it, but I get the first pick.
First, right? And when you're an only kid, one, that doesn't happen. And around the blame issue, if something happened, it either didn't happen or you did it. There are no other options other than your imaginary friend.
It was Harvey.
You know, it was Harvey, right?
The imaginary 6-foot rabbit friend behind me. Yeah.
And, you know, I bet our childhoods play into how we, obviously, they make us. But if you were not a talker as a child, mainly because other people were always talking,
right,
then you might have a harder time expressing, you know, that little pebble in your shoe that's such a bad rub. Or, and the people around you may not know it, and it could be very, you know, a hurdle for you to get over, and it gets heavier and heavier as your coworkers. I'll say no more.
Well, you know, to that point, I was involved in some of the early days of video conferencing. And in those early days, what people were doing was a voice-activated microphones would direct who got on screen. Uh-huh. What you quickly learned was that the strong silent type of management did not work, because guess what? You were never, your image was never up there.
That's it. You know, sometimes, it's interesting. Those who have a lot to say, mm-hmm. I mean, people who like to talk, they can turn a couple sentences into paragraphs.
Right.
And it sounds great. And you think, you know, but you may not feel the need to really chime in which case you feel like, did I contribute enough? And which isn't really conflict, but it's workplace dynamics. Which...
It is. And what I suggest is, this is why it's so important to understand each other's styles. If there is somebody who's quiet, who takes a long time to respond or to think about things, you need to give them the space to do that, because you need their input. I don't know if you've ever done the Myers-Briggs or other, you know, personality styles. When I'm in a group and we do this, or working with an organization, people are thrilled if most of them are in the same quadrant. And I'm really nervous because they're missing all those other perspectives. So it's great. We all get along and we'll move in a direction. But think how dangerous that could be if you don't have other perspectives coming in.
Right.
And I think what you're talking about here really picks up on something that Andrea was alluding to earlier, which is if you have conflict, you know, in your environment and you're a manager, I think one of the first lessons they teach you in management class is you're probably not the person qualified to solve that problem. Mm-hmm. Bring in an expert. I remember, you know, early on being told, if you find that you have an employee who has a financial problem, don't try to give them financial counseling.
Oh,
that's not what you do. You know, bring in an expert. And that's where I think people are relying more and more heavily on the human resource mm-hmm. department. And it has really, I think, elevated its role in a corporation and gone from being very much of a line function to really being much more strategic in terms of positioning, the kinds of people worrying about actively managing corporate culture.
Right.
I mean, a lot of development taking place there mm-hmm. and really all to the better in these very dynamic, quick-moving organizations.
Well, you know, I wonder if it's really to the better, because they're embedded in the organization. I almost feel as though an HR department—
Are you pushing back on me right now?
A little bit. I'm right. thinking HR
Can I
should,
help you?
Yeah. Should be more— I'm not saying regulatory.
Let me tell you something about her.
But I almost think that it's not having that kind of impact on the workforce that they service— you know, is not going to, there won't be a good income. You almost need an impartial, someone who comes in impartially, troubleshoots, you know, makes suggestions and then is gone. So everyone feels like they got the even, you know, and being heard evenly, or which is where a consultant or a subject matter expert, as we call them, you know, would really be useful, as opposed to leaning on the HR department to work these things out. I always look at them as being more regulatory in nature.
Yeah, I often suggest that HR, by the way, be on the executive team, because you need that perspective. From a legal perspective, you need it, but also because they do understand the culture. As an outside facilitator, you know, it's really much easier as an outsider. If I go into a group, I don't have a stake in the outcome. Whatever they decide is not going to affect me tomorrow because they don't work there. So I can completely devote myself to the process. That's all I care about. If I do have a stake in the outcome, so if I were doing it internally, I'd have to put my biases on the table. And it's really harder for people to trust that you're just paying attention to the process. Mm-hmm. So I certainly think there's a role. What I often suggest in organizations, if they're big enough, is have someone facilitate who is not within their department, but somebody who's outside. And sometimes HR will do it, and sometimes they'll just tap somebody in another department to help out if they happen to have the skills.
Yeah, I can tell you also sort of related to this in terms of having the skills to be able to do this and mm-hmm. intercede. I do some work in the crisis management disaster recovery area. And recently had the opportunity to work with a colleague who works with houses of worship and is launching an initiative to train ushers on how to deal with disruptive individuals.
Oh, interesting.
And has picked up on this. There's a series of courses called verbal jujitsu that you can use to turn people around, because as we've unfortunately seen, churches, religious environments, synagogues, other places like this, become a magnet to people who have maybe issues and maybe are disruptive personalities. And so the idea of being able to take ushers and people like that and give them just very, very basic orientation on how to lead the person away and, you know,
kindly
disrupt them and put yourself between them and moving forward in a non-threatening way. You know, there's a whole set of these skills that we really all, we kind of sort of know parts of this, but, you know, formal orientation, I think, would be really helpful in a lot of situations.
I think it helps. I think it helps in the workplace. I will often say when I'm training facilitators, if you have someone, for instance, who's just taking over and not letting anybody else talk, and you say to that person, well, you have to stop talking. Other people want to talk. Nobody else is going to say anything because that could happen to them. But if you were to say to the person, I can tell what you're saying is interesting to a lot of people because it looks like a lot of people want to jump in, that's respectful of the person who maybe was taking over, and it invites other people to come in. Mm-hmm. So even when folks say, oh, I wish they'd get rid of that person or they'd usher that person out of the situation, they're embarrassed and upset and disturbed when it happens in an unkind way.
Mm-hmm.
And we should be teaching this from the time kids are very little, by the way.
Mm-hmm. That's generational differences in the workplace, if I could turn the topic to that. How do you see, you know, there are some very definite generational differences around technology, but around, and I won't say work ethic, but maybe work style and work expectation. Do you see anything that is indicative of one generation over another? And I'm wondering how the millennials are all blending into this conflict.
Picking on the millennials again.
Yeah, there we go.
Now, I will make some comments, but I hesitate to stereotype because, of course, not everybody of a certain age fits in with that stereotype. This is the first time in American history where we've had so many places that have four generations in a workplace. People are not retiring as early. So we have one of the things that's requested the most is multi-generational work. Now, the other piece about this is even though people are being more careful about how they talk about other groups, they're not being that careful about talking about generational groups that are not their own. So I hear a lot of stereotyping saying, oh, young people don't have the same work ethic. They actually do, but they work differently. So the assumption is if they don't want to stay late or they don't want to come to a meeting, they'd rather Zoom in or be in a conference call, that they don't have a work ethic. It really is a different style. Mm. My favorite story was about a man who became a real curmudgeon. He was retiring. He was very crabby and grouchy. So this organization did this, and now they do it for all retirees. The last 3 months of tenure is sharing institutional wisdom. All those things people know just aren't written down. The young people could not wait for this guy to get out of there until he started sharing institutional wisdom. And then they were hanging on every word, begging him to stay. As a result, they closed the generation gap. And they every month they get together in a potluck to talk about, from your perspective, your generation, what do you know? They happen to have external customers. You know how much this helps? Because it's not just internally that they're working with multi-generations. Their customers are multi-generational.
Right.
And it's been enormously helpful. And they have much more respect for each other now.
Pick up on that a little bit and maybe turn the topic from conflict to these new work styles that Andrea was just alluding to.
Yeah.
I at least find that among my peers who are no longer working in a central location,
yes,
but have been asked to work from home.
Mm-hmm.
For many of them, the isolation has been very, very difficult for them to
right.
deal with. Is that pretty common?
It's very common, and it's hard to coalesce a team when people are all over the place. And then what happens is what I was talking about earlier is you're working through email, working through text, and sometimes on the phone. That means there isn't body language. I don't see you. I don't get to know you. I don't get to understand your style. I don't see you when we're not talking about a topic. So I don't run into you in the coffee room and have a little conversation.
You don't
with
really
you.
Build a wide relationship.
No.
It's a
right.
very point-on-point relationship.
Exactly. And people often say, well, you don't need to know about people's personal lives. It actually coalesces teams when you do. So that's part of the issue, is the point-on-point conversations that we have. I suggest, if it's at all possible, to bring people together a few times a year, physically bring them together so they can see each other. Before we got on this show, we were talking about how radio personalities, you hear them and then you make up a whole story about what they look like. And if you ever see them in person, it's a shock, right?
I'm laughing because I know everyone would be surprised at how we look, right?
And I don't want you telling people I get confused with Brad Pitt all the time.
Oh, exactly. Right. That's who you remind me of, right?
I'm the after picture. Whether before, I can't tell which.
After what? Right. That's the question. No.
So recognizing that it's an issue helps, of course. And I get a lot of frustration from supervisors who say, I have all these remote people, and sales is often a great example. They're doing a great job. They're there by themselves. We don't feel like we're coalesced at all. We are not coalesced with the rest of the organization. And so there is more conflict. It's easier to be mad at someone you never meet and you never have to see and you don't have to run into tomorrow. It just is. So we have to really develop a whole other way of doing it. Sometimes people will say, let's spend the first 10 minutes on our conference call talking about how people are. What's going on? What's the weather outside your window?
It's a great idea.
Yeah.
You know, I work at an off-campus location, and for a long time it was important to take an interest in what was going on in the main campus, and yet we were always excluded from it, and you develop kind of an apathy.
You do. Yeah.
And
it's reciprocal, too.
Right.
People forget you're there. I mentioned I'm married to an architect. Excuse me, and I, although he's doing natural playgrounds now, playgrounds without equipment, so not buildings. But I talk to him all the time about how architecture makes a difference. If I pass you in the hall regularly, I'll tell you a lot more. If I don't, I won't. That's the issue with shifts. If you're on the night shift or you're the morning shift or the weekend shift. So certainly if I don't pass you at all, it's not that I'm trying to marginalize you. I just don't think about it.
Right.
And you're lacking information.
So you're listening to Dr. Jerry King here on Business IQ Radio on 105.1 WBNH, and we're having a great discussion about a lot of topics dealing with human dynamics and really the work environment, and we've been exploring most recently this issue of new work styles. We have had a number of people in the past on the show who are coming from some of the business incubators,
mm-hmm.
And some very interesting work styles develop in those environments, and then people look to graduate out of those. And I also know from some things I've done in the past that the focus on getting a successful team remains number one in terms of investors. The old saying is, an investor will invest in an A team with a B idea versus
right.
versus a B team with an A idea.
Uh-huh.
And that really must be posing some challenges, because people are forced to come together very rapidly with huge potential financial incentives and mm-hmm. enormous pressure on them. And I think mm-hmm. that's really one of the dynamics that I'm seeing, is that the pressure on the startup teams is really amplified because the runway, the opportunity they have to be successful, has been narrowed. The expectation
right.
of producing results quickly mm-hmm. is so high and so demanding these days that you must see this, that people are under enormous
right.
stress.
I do. Interestingly, there's been sort of a shift. There are companies who are now paying for failures. because what they recognized was people were afraid. Well, what they recognized is people were afraid to come forth with ideas because they were afraid it would fail, and they were getting less good ideas as a result of that. So you get a bonus for failures, and out of that, you get more successes. Hmm. So it really is a huge switch in terms of that. The other thing we talked about, multi-generational, is how often people change jobs now. My grandparents would never have changed a job. And my parents wouldn't. And they, because for two reasons. One, you just stay loyal. But secondly, people would think you were flaky if you did that. And I'm sort of in the generation.
A job hopper.
Yeah, a job hopper. Right. We can't hire you. Now people are saying, if I go in and say I've been to the same place for 20 years, they're saying, what's the matter?
Yeah. You're wrong? Stale. I mean, yeah. Silicon Valley is famous now if you have a tenure of 14 months or more.
I know.
Why haven't you moved up and out?
That's right. Exactly. So it's there, and you can imagine this has caused some parent-child situation problems because the parents who are still loyal to their companies and the children who are saying, no, that's passé. The other thing is I remember our son's college graduation, it was during a recession, and a bunch of his friends were standing around saying, I will never be loyal to a company. So I wandered over and said, tell me about that. And they said, well, my parents left early in the morning, got home late at night, and instead of a gold watch, they were downsized. So depending on the culture you grew up in, depending on what happened in your society, in our society, really makes a difference about what happens to the next generation in the workplace.
And it's all about what happens to you individually.
Sure,
you just carry
of course.
It forward. So let me explore that a little bit as well. Previously, we've had some people on the show talking about trying to strike the balance between work and family.
Mm-hmm.
That obviously is a major cause of conflict in the workplace.
It is, and this is a generational issue. Young people are more apt to say, I want that balance. I'm leaving because I want to go to my kid's soccer game. What happens is, and I've talked to people of my generation and somewhat younger who have said, the reason I get mad at them is I'm jealous. Because I wish I'd gone to my kid's soccer game. You know, and I think jealousy for adults, we have to remember. I remember saying to our son when he was a teenager, I wish I could just hang out with my friends and not put out the trash. And then I realized that's true. I really wished I could hang out with my friends.
Right.
So it was envy that was perpetuating my annoyance. And I think it happens in the workplace as well.
So with respect to that work-life balance, you know, I know that as a new college graduate, pre-family, you know, I only had to answer to really one person, myself, and I would, you'd be a dedicated worker.
Sure.
After you have a family, you're juggling so much and you can't really be the mother you want and it might, you know, mm-hmm. or the worker you want. And you feel like you're always coming up a little short on one or the other.
Right.
And so a few years ago, I don't know if you remember this, that there was an article written in the Atlantic Monthly about a woman who was an advisor to, I think it was Hillary Clinton. And she, it was a big story. She had wrote this article about how she could no longer achieve, see her daughter back in New Jersey. And this was just terrible. She had to leave this position and, you know, how horrible it is for women who have to sacrifice their careers for their families, and this shouldn't be. And so she ended up leaving her position in Washington to her other full-time position, which was a tenured professor at Princeton.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I thought it was very interesting that she perceived that she couldn't have it all. And I wonder what about that tenured professorship didn't, you know, it might have been like a slap in the face to all of us other working women who, you know, don't have maybe the salary that she was getting. I don't know what she made, but or the single mothers that, you know, that are out there having to work. I wish as a young woman there had been a course or a seminar on what it means to be a college graduate expecting a career, but also a woman who would like to have a family.
Right.
And I have spent so much energy in that, you know, tossing all that around and trying to make it all work, emotional energy, physical energy. It's
interesting. It's interesting that there's a certain sexism associated with it. So that if and I think this still maintains, which sort of surprises me, where people will ask women more often how they achieve that balance, and they won't ask men. Considering my generation, this was really counterintuitive. Ron and I stayed home every other day with our son. And people asked about this all the time. They wondered about it all the time. And I didn't travel. Now I travel all the time for work, but I would just travel a little bit then. Whenever I traveled, people would say, well, who's taking care of Ethan? First of all, like I hadn't thought about it. You know, I thought, oh, I have the dress and I have the suit and I have the lecture. What was it? I forgot. One day I said to Ron, does anybody ever ask you who's taking care of Ethan when you travel? Never. Nobody ever asked him that. And he, interestingly, was insulted because the implication was that he couldn't parent by himself. Hmm. So it was, to both of us, it was sort of an unnerving response. Not everybody can do that. Not everybody can go back and forth, and not everybody has the kind of career where they can manage that, understandably. But what I wish is that people could talk about it more in the workplace. Mm-hmm. And we have an adage that says you have to leave your personal problems at the door. Well, where do you leave them? Is there a receptacle, like an umbrella stand? Aren't you worried you'll take the wrong one when you go home? We have one brain, one brain. And our problems come with us. And what we know, large companies now actually have psychologists on board. Smaller companies obviously can't. But what we know, if someone can come in and share some of their struggles, they can be more productive. Hmm. If they have to hold it back, that's where their energy goes.
Mm-hmm. And there is the tension, I'm sure, still where people want to know, oh, gee, it's a young woman. Will she still be with us, or is she going to become pregnant and leave us? And that whole area still continues to be an area of...
Absolutely does. Now, people understand, for the most part, that it's illegal not to hire somebody based on that. It's certainly illegal to be asking them that question.
And it's probably an example of where actually forcing something to be a law actually promoted proper attitudes and the right behavior.
Right. Thank you for saying that. But some of the pushback I get a lot is about political correctness, and this is a form of political correctness. But what political correctness does is it reminds us of our prejudices. It reminds us of our stereotypes, because if I have to stop myself from saying something, I think, oh, my goodness, I really believe this because of who this person is or gender or whatever other category that person falls back into. And also because of experiences I've had over my life, I came to the conclusion at one point I'd rather have people insincerely politically correct than sincerely abusive, just so we can get through our lives.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Your comment on prejudice, I just make a quick comment that if you've never been to the Simon Wiesenthal Center in New York City, it's worth going to. You go through, and as you tour the museum, it's not really a museum. It's actually a series of tests that explore at a deeper level all of the bias and prejudice you don't realize you have towards things like color and everything
else.
Interesting. And you come out the other side saying, I never realized I had all of that in me, and it's really it's a very powerful experience. I highly recommend it to anybody in New York City. I think it's down on like 23rd Street.
What is the name of that again?
Simon Wiesenthal Center. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's quite a powerful thing to do.
So. Thank you for that. I'm going to be in New York in a couple of weeks. Great. I'm going to try to do that.
Here,
so. Are you? Oh, my favorite city.
So if I can, sort of going on that whole thing about childcare, continuing on that issue. Even though we were saying that isolation is an element of people working at home, anybody who tries to get on Route 3 or 93 in the morning here knows that commuting has taken place. And now people are commuting hours to get to work. And if you've ever been in Silicon Valley, companies like Intel and Cisco and HP schedule their shifts so that their people can get to work on the roads. And so they have shifts that start at unusual times, like 2:30 a.m. because the neighboring companies aren't starting until 4 a.m. And there's actually ability to travel. So, again, a stress inducer on all of us.
So much.
The automobile has been a wonderful tool, but people are commuting enormous distances.
They are. And one of the reasons they're doing that, and this is left over from two recessions, is they don't want to move for a new job because they're not sure that job will last. So they're saying, well, I might as well just stay where I am and do this long commute just in case. Whenever I'm stuck on the highway, I look over, and what unnerves me the most is when people don't look upset. I think, oh, my gosh, they're so used to sitting here for 2 hours. They don't even look distressed by it or upset by it.
While they're trying to do their email.
I'd like to think of it as a book on tape. They've got their books on tape.
Right. Right.
So can I ask you about, I don't want to, you mentioned laid off, the term laid off,
mm-hmm.
or
downsize.
Firing. Mm-hmm. Well, downsize.
Reduction. In
reduction.
Force.
All of that sounds a lot better than fired.
It does.
But is there a different way, or how would an employer best go about preparing the workforce for something like that? I mean, on one hand, laid off or downsizing seems like it's an organizational thing that's mm-hmm. just going to happen, but firing is something specific to a person.
Or reorganizing is another euphemism for mm-hmm. You're going to lose your job. In the end, when you go in the supermarket, you still don't have the income to buy groceries.
Right.
It depends entirely how you're doing it. During the recessions, I would say to people, before you downsize, can you at least ask people how maybe they have ideas for saving money? The response I often get is, well, what if we still have to downsize? And say, well, at least they know you tried.
Right.
And there are some wonderful things that happen where people said, we'll give up our vacation pay so our colleagues can keep their jobs. We'll all cut down some hours. Now, that can't happen everywhere, and people can't always afford to do that. But how about if we start there? If you're letting someone go, whether it's because of reorganization or you're firing them, I implore people not to do it on a Friday afternoon. Here's a great example. You let somebody go on a Friday afternoon. That person goes home and maybe a loved one says, do we still have health insurance? They have no one to call. They have no one to access. So Monday, they call and they're angry, they're upset, they're distressed, or maybe their lawyer calls talking about unfair termination. Do it on a Tuesday when they can do that. Do it in a way that doesn't make them look like criminals. I mean, that's the other thing that happened a lot. Even if
escort you out.
Escort you out. Right.
Get security up here now.
Right. Don't say right. goodbye to anybody. Don't say anything. And and that happened not because people were fired for cause, but because they were downsizing by a third. You know, how about if we treat people respectfully, we try to do it in the morning? And people will say, well, we tell them everything they need to know. If you hear that you don't have a job anymore, you hear very little else.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You need follow-up.
Right.
Well, we're coming to the end of the show. This has been a delightful discussion with you, Jerry. Any points that you'd like to leave us, or any bits of advice or sort of nuggets of wisdom that you can leave behind here in the studio?
This is going to sound so schmaltzy. It really is. But there is no substitute for kindness. I have seen over and over, I remember this man who had to downsize because of finances. He was known for not being very emotional, and he burst out crying, and he left, and he came back, and he started crying. And finally, the third time, he came back crying and said, this is what I have to do. And even the people who lost their job said, at least he cares. So please feel comfortable to do that. People think if they're supervisors, they have to be stoic. I don't know where that stereotype came from, but I can tell you that I've rarely met a supervisor who wasn't devastated about having let people go or to tell them a negative thing. So how about if we just say we're human beings and this is how it's affecting us and I'm sorry, and try to deal with the fallout?
Well, thank you very, very much. This has been wonderful. Jerry, if people wanted to reach you, what's the best way for them to do that?
Well, I'm based in Concord, New Hampshire. And Human Dynamics Associates has a website, Jerry King, G-E-R-R-I, King. I have to say this. You see, my real name is Geraldine. It's the only issue I ever had with my mother. And I told her that. And I said it when I delivered her eulogy. And she said, of course, please feel free. And luckily, it's the only issue. So I'm in Concord, New Hampshire, and I'm accessible through Human Dynamics Associates are my name.
And your website, again, is
www.jerryking.com.
Jerry with an I.
with an I and two R's.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks.
And I'm going to turn things over to my friend and colleague who, as she does every week, signs us off with some advice for those of you in business. Over to you, Andrea.
Yeah, I'd like to thank you also, Jerry.
My pleasure.
I did take a conflict resolution class with you, and it was just, the day flew by, and you just were a wonderful, wonderful teacher. So
thank you.
Great to have you in the studio today. So I'd like to remind our listening audience that you can spend more than you make, but you can only do it for so long.